This is the last in the series, and last in everything for me. I'll be leaving this afternoon at Holden. But last in a sort of mini-series we've been doing this week on Central America. My name is Joel Muggy. I'm the director of the Center for Global Education in Minneapolis, and I think, as many of you know, our work is to coordinate travel seminars to many parts of the Third World, but especially to Latin America. And I guess Central America is the area that I know the best. I've probably been there 25 or 30 times in the last 6 years or so. What we did, how many of you, this is your first session on Central America this week? Okay, so some of you, most of you have been in some of the other sessions. I'll try to review just a couple of key points so you know where we're at in this discussion. The first of the sessions, we talked about liberation theology and the role that it has played in the kind of the revolutionary struggles in Central America, and how liberation theology sort of undergirds much of the motivation for why there has been this kind of rebellion. Then last, on Thursday, we talked about sort of the political and economic roots to the crisis in Central America, and a little bit about the reasons for our policy in the light of those social and economic circumstances, political and economic circumstances. Today, I want to talk a little bit more about our current policy and what I think are the flaws in it, and then talk about some alternatives. And a key in that, of course, is the Arias plan. Let me give these to you before I forget. And we'll talk about the Arias plan and sort of the prospects for peace as I see them today, and then we can talk about that. So let me begin. I want to begin with a couple of quotes that I think are very interesting. The first, I'll let you guess who it's by. The national security of all the Americas is at stake in Central America. If we cannot defend ourselves there, we cannot expect to prevail elsewhere. Our credibility would collapse, our alliances would crumble, and the safety of our homeland would be put in jeopardy. You got that? It's from Ronald Reagan's address to Congress in April of 1983. It was sort of his first major policy address on Central America, in which he really laid out what our policy was to Central America. Now, another quote. This was actually a response to that quote and that speech. Yes, your alliances will crumble and your security will be endangered if you do not demonstrate that you are an enlightened, responsible power in your dealings with Latin America. Yes, you must demonstrate your humanity and your intelligence here in this hemisphere we share, or nowhere shall you be democratically credible. And that, I think, anybody guess who that was? That's much more difficult.
Andrew Ollendorf.
No.
Somebody like Camara?
No, it was Carlos Fuentes, who is a Mexican novelist and diplomat, and he spoke at the Harvard commencement in that year, 1983, and it was really a direct response to Reagan, saying, yes, your security is endangered if you keep up the way you're doing in the region. And I think these two quotes frame, I think, the central issues in the debate over Central America, and that is the credibility and long-term self-interest of the United States. In the final analysis, you know, if we're going to talk about the implications of the policy, the only way we're going to make change in this country is to talk about it in terms of our own self-interest. That's a sad but true reality, I'm afraid. And while we may see it damaging to Central America, I think in the long run we have to see it as damaging to us as well. Now, where I want to begin today is to talk a little bit about this notion of national security. For some of you who heard my last lecture, the final lecture last week, this will be a little repeat, but it's just in a small section, because if you remember when we finished on Thursday, those of you here, we talked about this whole national security ideology being so central to U.S. foreign policy in the region. And that this ideology is one that sees reality in such dualistic terms that all international conflicts are seen as manifestations of the struggle against communism, and particularly against the Soviet Union. So a country like Nicaragua, for example, that opts for some kind of third way, there's no there's no room in the worldview in this administration to accept the possibility of a third way. You're either with us or against it. In the case of Nicaragua, they're against us. So this national security mentality or ideology is one I'll come back to at the end. But it really, I think it's very damaging in terms of our overall view of foreign policy. One of the implications of this national security ideology is that we have come to see in this country the relationship between economic and political systems in a very simplistic and, I think, false way. I think most of us have been conditioned, basically, to see that in the range of political and economic possibilities lie somewhere on a spectrum from democratic capitalist to totalitarian socialist / Marxist regimes. So we, in the way we've been taught in our schools, I think we've been taught to identify these two things and identify these two things, and to see that somehow all countries and systems in the world lie somewhere on the scale between those two extremes. And I think in this administration, even it's gone further in saying there really isn't anything in between. It's these two extremes. I'd like to suggest there's a much better way for us to think about the relationship between economic and political systems, and it helps us understand a little bit also about the way our foreign policy works. And that's to see the relationship between those as a kind of matrix where we have democracy up there, totalitarianism here, capitalism here, socialism, Marxism here. Now this is an oversimplification too, but I think it's better than the other way of looking at it. And what this suggests then is we take economic and political systems and we put them somewhere on this grid. And if you do that, then you find some interesting things. Somebody like Stalin would probably have been down in there, but someone like Pinochet in Chile would be over here. Now, I don't want to get into an argument about this because we could, and that's about where the U.S. would go on this grid. Popular culture would suggest that the U.S. is somewhere in here. We might argue about that. I think I might also. But that is where we would tend to put ourselves, actually probably more over here. But a nation like Scandinavian countries, Norway, Sweden, might be more over in here. And obviously, this is not a very scientific model. You could make it more scientific by developing criteria for putting them in a particular place. But from a sort of a gut reaction of my own experience in a country like Nicaragua, for example, I would put Nicaragua somewhere in here. A country that certainly has opted for a kind of socialism, but where there's a significant private sector. 60% of the economy is still in the private sector. Where there certainly have been some restrictions to individual and personal freedom, but where if democracy is measured by the level of public participation in decision making, Nicaragua has a strong some strong aspects of democracy that are very much alive and very much a part of it. And I would frankly put countries like Guatemala and El Salvador down in here. Those countries that our country likes to talk about as democracies. The Soviet Union, for example, might be somewhere in here, and certainly moving in probably some of those directions, right? So this is just another kind of simple model, but I think it helps to suggest something about the way we see the relationship between economic and political systems. And I think The relevance for me to this right now is to suggest that one of the problems with U.S. foreign policy has been our tendency to support countries that fall in this half of the matrix, rather than, if we were really being true to what I think our principles should be in foreign policy, that we'd be supporting countries in this half of the matrix. Right? If that were the case, it's my opinion that we'd have a much different kind of relationship to Nicaragua, for example. I just leave that with you, and that some people find that helpful as a way of understanding those relationships. Now, before I talk about the peace plan and our response to it, I want to talk a little bit about what's wrong with our current policy. I think most of you were at the sessions this week, and we talked about some of what's wrong with the policy. And I think what's most important is to look at what are the potential consequences of our current policy in Central America. And my basic proposition here is going to be that, as I started in the beginning, while current U.S. policy is not in the interest of the people of Central America, I think neither does our policy serve the long-term self-interest of the United States, and I think it runs counter to our interests. First of all, when we identify our interests with governments that are gross violators of human rights and show little regard for democracy, this destroys our values and damages our credibility. Revolutions arise from economic injustice and political repression, not as well as from poverty. It seems to me that fostering equitable development and democratic institutions is the only way to guarantee long-term stability and peace. But we get involved in supporting groups like the Contras, who are gross violators of human rights. It simply destroys our credibility in the rest of the world. Secondly, war is not only costly in terms of lives and resources, it undermines democratic institutions. Our presence in Honduras, for example, today is the most important factor in destroying Honduran democracy today. It's pushing more and more, giving the military in Honduras more and more power, and leading to increasing repression within Honduras today. War generates large numbers of refugees, many of whom end up in the United States. And it ought to be in the U.S. interest, it seems to me, to lower the level of violence in Central America rather than raise it. And our current policy raises the level of violence. And it ought to be in our interest to decrease the level of resources used on military expenditure. Third, I think, the most serious threat to U.S. economic well-being, and I think Barry has done a good job of pointing that out this week, is the debt crisis, not the Central America situation. And the overreaction, I think, of the United States to internal upheavals in Central America serves to draw attention away from the debt crisis, which we're not dealing with at all, and certainly the international implications of this huge debt. Fourth, and perhaps most critical in terms of the results of this policy, is that this policy simply will not work in achieving the United States' own objectives. What I'm going to do here is, let's give Ronald Reagan his due for a moment. Let's say that we agree with Reagan that the Sandinistas need to be wiped out, we need to put a government in Nicaragua that we can control, and we've got to keep the rebels, we've got to defeat the rebels in El Salvador and Guatemala. We've got to put a stop to revolution in the region. Even if that is our, if we accept that goal, which I hope you realize I don't, but if we accept that, our policy doesn't have a chance of achieving that goal. First of all, it fails to recognize the historic roots of the problem. Revolutions and civil wars in Central America have indigenous roots. They are the results of decades of poverty and oppression of the people of the region. They're not the product of a Soviet-Cuban conspiracy. And our policy serves to worsen, not improve, the conditions that are at the root of the crisis. And those of you here, we talked about that, the effects of the Alliance for Progress and what it really did in the long term in Central America. Another reason it's not going to work is that U.S. policy fails to recognize the broad base of popular support that these revolutionary movements have in the countries in which they're going on. We seek to defeat guerrilla movements, as we're doing and trying to do in El Salvador today, refusing to recognize that these relatively small groups of armed combatants have the moral and logistical support of hundreds of thousands of people. And I think another reason our policy will ultimately fail is that it has gained neither the domestic support nor the international credibility it needs to succeed. Most Latin American nations, most of our allies in Europe, have expressed misgivings about our growing buildup in the region, our military buildup, and about our ongoing undeclared war against Nicaragua. And public opposition, I think, in the United States grows as the costs and risks of the current policy become clear. For many years, for example, every major poll that's been done on contra-aid has shown that the U.S. public opposes contra-aid by margins as much as 2-1. And yet, even during this period, the Congress has voted contra-aid. So I think the policy will not work in achieving the objectives. Now let me even go one step further. Let's say that we could achieve the Ronald Reagan's objectives. Let's say it were possible that the present policies could succeed in accomplishing U.S. objectives. That is, it were possible to get rid of the Sandinistas and stop revolution in Central America. What would be the cost of such a so-called victory? A victory over the revolutionary groups would cost hundreds of thousands more lives. I think there's absolutely no question about that. In addition to the more than 100,000 lives already lost in the region, there'd be further large-scale disruptions in the economies of the region, while present policies have cost hundreds of millions of dollars, the defeat of opposition forces would cost billions of dollars, to be provided, of course, by whom? Many of you remember the Kissinger Commission report of a couple of years ago. It was a good start at providing those billions of dollars to defeat revolutionary movements. And finally, I think we have to realize that a continuation of our present policy could lead in the long term not only to disaster in Central America, but it's one of many potential conflict areas of the regions that could lead to an escalation of an international crisis that reaches nuclear proportions. Now, how could that happen? Well, let's say that the United States did invade Nicaragua. Cuba has said it would not support Nicaragua in a military confrontation with the United States, but I don't believe it. I think Cuba would support Nicaragua. So Cuba comes to Nicaragua's aid in a more direct way than it's now assisting Nicaragua. That gives the United States the excuse that it's always wanted to go after Cuba, and then who is committed to backing up Cuba, right? You see how that kind of escalation, it's certainly not hard to imagine it. So I think while many oppose current U.S. policies on ethical grounds, and I certainly do join those who do, I think there is also a very pragmatic argument for opposition to these policies. So to me, at least, it's very clear that a new course is needed in Central America. An alternative to the present policy of defeating revolutionary movements has to be a political approach to the conflicts, which means a willingness to seriously consider a negotiated settlement. It just seems so self-evident to me that that's what it's going to take to resolve this situation, that a military solution is not an option. It simply cannot work. And so what of the attempts at a negotiated solution? And I want to talk about perhaps the best thing going today, of course, is the Arias Plan. But the Arias Plan is not the first thing going. For years, there has been a steady stream of proposals for alternate approaches to a policy in Central America and for a negotiated solution to the region. U.S. policymakers have either disregarded those proposals or sought to nullify them by clothing their own militaristic solutions in a new and sort of political dress. You know, the best example, of course, was the proposal by the United States that was submitted 2 days before the President signed the Arias proposal. You know, fearing that the Presidents would sign it, seeking to water it down, and of course, thankfully, the Central American Presidents ignored the U.S. proposal. So, perhaps the best known process prior to the Arias plan was the Contadora plan, or the Contadora peace process. Now, the Contadora peace process was working for a number of years. It was a process that was designed and carried out by the governments of Mexico, Panama, Colombia, and
Venezuela.
Yeah, sorry, blanking. And there were a number of support countries. The Contadora plan was really a Central America initiative to try to bring a negotiated solution to the conflict in Central America. The plan went through many stages of meetings and modifications, and it came to the point where the U.S. was not a party to the Contadora plan, as it is not to the Arias plan, but the U.S. is certainly a very active player in all of this. At one point, a few years ago, it looked like most of the countries besides Nicaragua were willing to sign the plan. The United States suspected Nicaragua wouldn't sign it. To everyone's surprise, Nicaragua agreed to sign the plan at that point, which sent U.S. policymakers scurrying to Honduras and El Salvador to point out to Honduras and El Salvador why it was not in their interest now to sign the plan. And so they backed off in signing it, the point at which it came closest to Contadora actually succeeding. This kind of manipulation has been a constant problem in the peace plans. I had an opportunity to speak with a Mexican diplomat at one point who was very involved in the Contadora peace plan. And during this whole process, the United States was giving lip service to Contadora, saying we support Contadora, so forth and so on. This Mexican diplomat said, you know, we all know that Contadora would be signed tomorrow if the United States were behind it. The United States simply does not support the Contadora plan. So, out of all of this then came Oscar Arias of Costa Rica, who announced a 10-point regional plan in February of 1987 that had many of the components of the Contadora plan, but not some of the most difficult parts, and we'll talk about those differences in a moment. Oscar Arias announced a 10-point regional plan for peace in the region, which was met initially by a good deal of positive regard. The various presidents of the region responded very positively to it. In June, there was a meeting was planned, June 25th, a meeting was planned for the five Central American presidents to meet in Guatemala. Just before that meeting, on June 15th, Duarte of El Salvador backed out of the meeting. And it was rescheduled for August 7th. Now at that point, Ortega said, if Duarte's not going to come on the 25th, I'm not going to come in August. But he did. I mean, it was a political move at that point to say, you know, just to not let Duarte kind of get by with this. So the meeting was rescheduled for the 7th of August. On August 4th, the Reagan-Wright Peace Initiative was announced. That is, knowing that this plan was coming on the 7th, knowing the contents of what they're about to sign, the Reagan administration gets together with Wright and proposes an alternative plan, which is as you can imagine, a much watered-down version of... Well, it takes out a lot of the stuff that's central to the Arias plan. On August 6th, in fact, to try to take this seriously, Ortega offers direct talks on the Reagan plan with the United States, is willing to talk with the United States about the Reagan plan. The U.S. refuses to talk with Ortega about that plan. And then on August 7th, what I think is one of the most marvelous things that has happened in the last decade, the five Central American presidents ignore the Reagan-Wright initiatives, absolutely ignore it, and go ahead and sign the agreement. And these are countries, and what's most remarkable is that presidents like Ascona of Honduras and Duarte of El Salvador ignored it, because you know, those two countries are very key for us and are really the vehicles through whom we carry out our policy. So the plan was signed. What's the essence of the Arias plan? And let me run through the 10 points of the Arias plan for you. And then I'll talk about some of the differences between it and Contadora. The first one is the idea of amnesty and internal dialogue. The intention is that there should be amnesty within 60 days for all political crimes in the country and dialogue with unarmed opposition groups. Now, note that the Arias plan does not call for Nicaragua to dialogue with the Contras, because it calls for dialogue with unarmed opposition groups within the country. This is a point that Nicaragua's been making, that all along they've been going beyond the Arias plan and agreeing to negotiate with the Contras. But keep that in mind. It's a very important point. Now, what happened, of course, is when this plan was announced, El Salvador initiated a dialogue with the guerrillas in El Salvador to put pressure on the Nicaraguans to dialogue with the Contras. I mean, it was a U.S. strategy to put pressure to move the... And then saying that if Nicaragua didn't do it, they weren't complying with the Arias plan. Dialogue with unarmed opposition groups was never called for in the Arias plan. And in fact, one saw that the dialogue with the guerrillas in El Salvador only went as long as it was politically wise to put that pressure on the Nicaraguans. Those talks fell apart in no time, once it was determined that that dialogue didn't need to be carried on. Secondly, a ceasefire should be declared by the area governments, the details to be worked out. Now, that ceasefire has never happened in El Salvador with the guerrillas. It has taken place in Nicaragua. It's fragile, and gets more fragile every day, but as you know, the ceasefire plan was signed between the Contras and the... A ceasefire was agreed to between the Contras and the Sandinistas in this village of Sapoa on the Costa Rican border earlier this year. Ceasefire was never declared in Guatemala because Guatemala refused to admit that there's a war going on. Then a calendar of democratization, a calendar for full press and political party freedoms in 60 days. Now, these timelines were stretched out in most cases, and in some cases they haven't fulfilled all the parts of the plan. But most of you will remember that Nicaragua did open up the presses considerably, reopened La Prensa, gave press freedom, ended censorship, and that sort of thing. Those movements were less clear in other countries because, again, they refused to accept that there were things like press censorship. Yet one goes to a place like Costa Rica, the bastion of democracy, and there's an incredible press censorship, not necessarily restricted by the government, but it's a kind of self-censorship because all of the media are in the hands of very right-wing political forces in Costa Rica. So the press in Costa Rica is absolutely unbelievable in terms of the way it perceives reality. Number four, free elections, supervised by the OAS, held according to schedules in each country's constitution. That would mean 1988 would be elections for a Central American parliament and for president in El Salvador. In 1989, Honduras, and in 1990, Costa Rica, Guatemala, and Nicaragua. The Arias plan calls for free elections in accordance with their constitutions, not right now, as the United States wants to call for in Nicaragua. Number five, it calls for the suspension of military aid to Contras and other guerrillas. The five countries address the appeal to all outside parties to cease military aid to guerrilla groups in the region. And this is a very important point. The Arias plan calls for an end to the aid to the Contra, as it calls for the end to outside support for the guerrillas in El Salvador. But it's very important here that this point does not affect the guerrillas in El Salvador very much because they get very little outside aid from outside the country. Most of the support for the guerrillas in El Salvador is internal. It comes from the biggest source is U.S. military aid. because of the amount of U.S. weapons that have been captured from El Salvadoran military and bought from El Salvadoran military through graft and corruption. I mean, there's all sorts of stories about a soldier going out into the woods with a M16 and coming back with money in his pocket, right? I mean, it really is, I think, accurate to say the largest segment of support for the Salvadoran guerrillas is U.S. military aid, in one way or another.
We're arming both sides.
Huh?
We're arming both sides.
Right, except we're not intentionally doing it, but that's what happens. So this point clearly affects Nicaragua more than it affects El Salvador, because the Contras are almost exclusively funded by the United States. Also related to this point was the sixth point, the non-use of territory for guerrilla attacks. That's saying one country should not be used as a territory for an attack on the other. Here's really Costa Rica and Honduras saying, we don't want our borders being used for attacks on Nicaragua, right? And I think Honduras's policy has been, Honduras's way they have handled this whole thing all along shows that on the one hand they don't want it, on the other hand they have no choice, because Honduras has to this day consistently refused to officially acknowledge that Contras are based in Honduras. I mean, I've visited the Contra headquarters a block from the U.S. Embassy in Tegucigalpa 3 or 4 times a number of years ago. The Honduran government says the Contras are not in Honduras. That sort of official stance. But so the Arias plan calls for an end to that presence. There is a plan, the seventh point, it has to do with arms reduction. Talks are to begin within 60 days to scale down the armies in the proportion to the population and the gross national product to disarm the Contras and other guerrillas. Now, very little has happened in that point, because the other points aren't far enough along to do that. Verification. Within 30 days, a follow-up committee composed of the Secretaries General of the UN and the OAS and the foreign ministers of Contador and support groups will visit the countries. Now that verification happened, it didn't happen within 30 days, but a verification happened. The United States was very unhappy with the report of the verification plan, because it basically said Nicaragua was complying more than many of the other countries was. And so that was quickly buried, that whole verification plan. It didn't get any press, it was sort of slipped under the table. A new meeting was held with the presidents to evaluate the progress. That occurred. And then the last point was the concept of the indivisible whole. That is, that the points included in this document form a harmonic and indivisible whole. The document takes effect upon signature. That is, when they signed that, the document had an effect. And that it wasn't sort of, we can negotiate this point and then we'll eliminate this point. That the whole thing is one package. It's all or nothing. You got to. This thing is a combination of things that fit together. Now, what was in the plan, the Arias plan, that is not in, or what was in Contadora, rather, that's not in the plan? And I should say before I mention this, part of this plan is to suggest that the Arias plan is a first step. And a first step to move towards some of the other points in the Contadora proposal. So the Arias plan was seen as a kind of a doorway into some of the other points in the Contadora proposal. It's very interesting the things that were left out, and you see how pragmatic Arias was in this, knowing just simply the things where the United States particularly was going to be immovable. Number one, Arias does not call for the withdrawal of all military advisors. It does not call for the withdrawal of foreign military advisors. That is, Soviet or Cuban or whoever else in Nicaragua, or U.S. advisors in all the other countries of the region. It does not call for that. It does not call for a ban on all arms imports, which Contador did. It does not put a restriction on foreign military exercises, especially U.S. military exercises in Honduras. Contador did do that. And finally, it does not call for the closing of all foreign military bases. There really aren't foreign military bases in Nicaragua in the way that the basic foreign military bases is the U.S. bases in Honduras. You know, there are Soviet and Cuban advisors in Nicaragua, which is not a Soviet base by any shape of the imagination. So those were the points that were not addressed by the Arias plan, but the hope was that this would be the next step in the process. Now, what are the current hopes for the implementation of the Arias plan? It's really been a roller coaster, I think, in terms of sort of public opinion and hopes in the region. And one of the things that we've found, our staff in Nicaragua says, it is tremendously wearing on the Nicaraguan people, this hope for peace that what they see as the insincerity of the Contras in their negotiating efforts. Well, let me come to that in a minute. What are the current hopes for implementation? I think there are many negative factors at work here. The Contras' intransigence in the face of the possibility of the plan's success is a very serious one, I think. The only serious Contra proposal that beyond the ceasefire, when both parties, the Sandinistas and the Contras, would come to the table with proposals, the only serious Contra proposal went way beyond the agreements of the ceasefire at Sapoa and cut directly across Nicaragua's constitution. In other words, the Contras plan, which is basically designed by the United States, you just have to accept that that's what's happening here, is that it's being designed by the U.S., basically meant that Nicaragua had to simply eliminate its constitution in order to implement these things within 60 days. So here is a government, ours, criticizing Nicaragua for being undemocratic, yet calling for a proposal that calls on the Sandinistas to ignore their own constitution. Which was a very incredible process in which that constitution was developed. The study documents went out to all the country in the smallest barrios. They were discussing the constitution, fighting about it, arguing about it. I mean, we once visited a meeting discussing the constitution. You should have seen the debate that went on in there, you know. And the constitution had emerged out of this process. So what we're saying is to the Sandinistas, okay, throw out your constitution. We want new elections. And well, anyway, that's... Now, the second negative factor, I think, is, and I suggested that, is the U.S. commitment to failure of the plan and the pressure it puts on El Salvador and Honduras to carry out its will. This is a very serious problem, I think, the U.S. pressure on El Salvador and Honduras not to carry through at key points in the plan when it appears that Nicaragua is in fact complying. I think another factor is going to be the deteriorating political situation in El Salvador. And I talked the other day about the emergence of the right wing in El Salvador again, and the deterioration of the political situation, the victory of ARENA, the right-wing political party in the assembly elections, the growth of more death squads activity in Honduras. It's become really very serious, for example, for the Lutheran Church in El Salvador today, and Medardo Gomez and his work, the risks that he's increasingly taking because of his work. So that emergence in El Salvador is not going to contribute to the plan. Certainly the recent actions of the Nicaraguan government, which provoke a U.S. response, that is the ouster of U.S. diplomats, and I'm going to talk about that a bit in a moment, but that is does not bode positively for the success of the plan, primarily because of the way the U.S. then responds to it. And I think the possibility of continuation of U.S. aid to the Contra is a very negative factor in the possibility of the plan's success. It's my opinion that if the United States passes a major aid bill again for the Contra, the Arias plan is dead. And if unless it's, a $3 million kind of token thing, but if there's another 25 or 30, or I'm not sure what the figure now is the administration is proposing, does anybody know? If that kind of plan is approved by Congress, I think that's really the end of the Arias plan. And it's clear that nobody wants that aid. Arias keeps pleading with the administration not to give aid to the Contras, and yet we keep pursuing that. Now, on the positive side, I think there are some aspects of the current political atmosphere in the U.S. that offer the potential for a policy change that would support rather than undermine the new hope that has been developed by the Central Americans. And it's really important to recognize that the Arias plan is a plan that has grown from the Central Americans themselves. It's not a U.S.-imposed plan. It's not imposed from somewhere else. I think the possibility of a new administration holds the possibility for new policy approaches. I suspect there'd be not much policy change in a Bush administration, but perhaps some. Maybe there'd be a little more neglect of the policy, which would, even that would be better. But if there is a Dukakis administration, at least Dukakis has been very strong in opposition to aid to the Contra. And I think we would see a qualitative change in the direction of our policy in Central America. I think at the same time Congress has, considering Contra aid, the Congress has increasingly been responsive to Central America initiative. I think Congress has more recently been favorable when Central Americans have taken the initiative and are less likely than they would have been 5 years ago to do something that runs counter to that initiative. Doesn't mean they won't. I think it's simply that it's less likely. I think the recent exposure of Reagan administration drug connections in Honduras and Panama, though it's awful easy for us, the media, to bury that and for it not to get the press, I think it should continually get, it does cast doubt on the current policy approach. I think it doesn't give Congress confidence in the approach when that kind of stuff keeps surfacing. And finally, I think the Reagan doctrine of containment, which refers to containing the alleged threat of communist expansion at all costs, is becoming increasingly suspect as the magnitude of those costs become exposed. If the peace process in the region continues to unfold, some policy changes could come, I think, in the U.S. approach to the region. So I guess I'm at a point of modest hope about what might happen. I have less hope today than I did a month ago, but I certainly have more hope now than I did 6-8 months ago. And so I think there is we're at a very tricky time in our policy towards Central America, and I think there is at least some elements of hope that are there. I think I'll really lose hope if Contra aid is passed again. Now, the other thing that's happening that is, I think, very hopeful, and that is that many analysts and policymakers are working toward an alternative approach to relationships in the region. That is, to the relationship of the United States and Central America. And I think this is what sets apart Central America maybe from some other conflict areas, especially, for example, the Middle East. And that is, there is not a lack of clear alternatives to our policy. What's lacking is the will to carry them out. There is not a lack of alternatives, it seems to me, which are relatively easy to implement. One of the best alternatives, some of the most in-depth work, has been done by a group called Policy Alternatives for Central America and the Caribbean. PACA, it's called for short, and it's sort of affiliated with the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington. But they've done a very comprehensive plan for an alternative policy for Central America. Let me just mention some of the aspects of this plan. Has a number of points that move towards ending the regional war, stopping all military and economic efforts to destabilize the government of Nicaragua, and ending aid to the Contra, of course. Halting maneuvers in Honduras and disarming the Contra forces within those territories. Cutting off aid for waging the war in El Salvador and Guatemala and support negotiated solutions in those countries. That's their first package of proposals, which they attempt to end the regional war. Secondly, there's a set of proposals that is designed towards forging a kind of durable peace for the region, to reopen bilateral talks with the United States and Nicaragua, to develop a treaty that bans foreign military bases and military personnel from the region, including Soviet and Cuban forces, but also including the United States, to support efforts for democracy in the region, including free elections, with guarantees, but elections according to the constitutions of the country. Then I think there's the whole need to rebuild Central America. Central America has suffered tremendous damage because of the war. And so there's a set of proposals that PACA has responded to do that, to take the lead in assembling an international program of assistance to rebuild Central America, to target development assistance to groups that increase the participation of the poor in the region's economies. And that would include supporting genuine land reform, not the kind of sort of superficial land reform that we supported in El Salvador. A proposal that calls for conditioning U.S. aid on compliance with internationally recognized standards of human rights, as well as a respect for indigenous peoples' culture and tradition. And finally, to really support a rejuvenated Central American common market, which the United States has never been terribly supportive of, because it saw it not in its own economic interest for the countries of the region to be involved in the common market. Obviously, that gives them more leverage as a unit. So, I mean, this is just one example of many alternative policy approaches that have been presented and are being discussed at relatively high levels. And I think they are at levels, certainly, for example, this executive director of the Institute for Policy Studies, under which the PACA project is being been developed, took a leave of absence to be Jesse Jackson's policy director for his campaign. So these kind of proposals are now at a level, I think, within the decision-making structure that they have some chance of at least being heard. And I think one of our responsibilities is to try to make sure that these policy approaches are given a hearing. Let me close with just some last comments about this whole question of national security. I began with that national security has been such an important concept in U.S. foreign policy. And I think with this administration, this administration has almost been obsessed with the idea of national security, which is why it seems to me it's ironic that our current policy has, in fact, put U.S. national security at stake. I think it's put it at risk. When we support groups, I mean, national security is enhanced by cultivating friends, not creating enemies. When we support groups like the Contra that are such gross violators of human rights, it destroys our credibility around the world. Virtually no other nation among our allies, our European allies, supports our position in Central America. Most Latin American nations do not support our position. Most nations around the world do not support our position. We're increasingly isolated in the way we view that. And all of that in no way does that enhance our credibility and our integrity around the world. And when we become ourselves violators of human rights and engage in violations of international law, as we have done in our war in Nicaragua, then I think our credibility is lessened even further. The only way, it seems to me, to really guarantee our national security is to help somehow build a community of nations that support and are friendly to us. It seems to me it was one of the tragedies of U.S. foreign policy that we did not somehow initially find a way to develop a friendly relationship with the government of Nicaragua. It would have, I think, moderated some of the directions that the Nicaraguans have moved that are of concern to us, and it was certainly something that was sought very carefully by the Nicaraguan government early on. But it wanted to do it on its terms, not always on our terms. So it seems to me that this whole question, finally, we have to begin to see that our policy, not only in Central America, but in many other places where we're engaged with a similar kind of policy, is in the final analysis a threat to our own national security, because it undermines our credibility and distances our closest allies from us. Okay, let me stop there and give you a chance to respond or ask questions.
Hello. I went on one of your travel seminars to El Salvador, Nicaragua last year.
Uh-huh.
I went with Mavis Lund, and
yeah.
Dorothy Soley was the
Mm-hmm.
teacher on that trip. And I can speak from both the painful side that you mentioned last night at Vespers. It was the most painful 2 weeks for me, but it was the most liberating 2 weeks because I learned about the gospel from the people that are living the gospel. And also I learned about how we, by our complacency in this situation, are part of the problem. Mm-hmm. The people down there love us. They don't hate us. They dislike government actions against them. They do not hate the people in the U.S. and Canada. I'm Canadian, by the way.
Right.
And we ask the question, what value are people like us that come down there? And people like Witness for Peace and the Sanctuary Movement and others. And a Baptist minister in Nicaragua, a lady, said to us, you're like the fleas on a dog. She says, don't take offense. She said, the dog is the U.S. government. You're the fleas that keep it scratching so it can't bite. And says, people like you have to keep coming down, have to keep witnessing back in your homeland. And they love us down there. And I got nothing but good feelings about the people and nothing but pain for what we're doing down there.
Right. And I think that what you're saying about the fondness of the people of Central America for the people of North America is really true, and it's true in other places. I find that's been true in the Philippines, and also, and I think it's even that we're eventually going to put at risk, because I think many times when I hear that, and I've heard that time and time again from people of Central America, you're not our enemy, it's your government who's our enemy. And I want to say, don't be so naive, you know. See, and the reason they can say that is because they've never understood until recently, for in the case of Nicaragua and other countries, not at all, they've never understood a government that really represents the people.
Right.
And we think, and so they excuse us, because obviously your government doesn't represent you either. Well, does it?
Yes.
I guess I'm more pessimistic than you are. I think maybe because the center of my attention has been Nicaragua as much as been El Salvador and Guatemala. If you sort of draw back from Nicaragua, it seems to me you see more of the indigenous and intransient roots of the hostilities on both sides. For me, I think one of the most hopeful things that one could mention is democratization of the church, of the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
Clearer in some parts than in others, but it seems to me that's the only place where people on a day-to-day basis have an experience of democracy.
Mm.
And without that experience, I'm not sure how you build larger democratic structures.
Yeah, that's precisely true, and I think that's part of what I was trying to say earlier this week in that whole session on base Christian communities. I mean, that is so key. I think part of what does give me a little hope is that my attention has been more focused on Nicaragua. And I frankly, when I let myself think about in the way I really should more about El Salvador and Guatemala, my hope is less as well. I mean, I think that's. And yet there is, you know, part of even is in that, the contact with those people in Guatemala and El Salvador who are so very hopeful, many of them. There is, somehow that also gives fount to hope. I mean, if it really does.
The trust reason for being so heavily involved is national security. Where did that begin? Didn't that begin generally with the
Monroe Doctrine? I think so. I think we could say that it did. But I think there's also a real sense in which it took a new turn after World War II. I had an interesting quote that I used last week by George Kennan, where he basically, in 1948, and it's in 1948 where the whole national security apparatus is established, you know. And George Kennan essentially says, you know, we have 50% of the world's wealth and 6-something% of the world's population, and in order to basically we have developed a policy to maintain that disparity. That's what he says. You know, that if in order for us to maintain our way of life, we need to be able to develop policies that maintain that disparity without undue suffering on the part of our own people. And so it's out of that that the whole policy of, you know, national security and what's in the recent manifestations of that, this whole idea of low-intensity conflict, that really is intended to stop these kind of revolutionary groups at minimal cost to, in terms of the U.S.
But security at that time was built around land war, men in the trench, and the world changed.
Right.
Go back, though, to the Monroe Doctrine, which was when?
When was when? 1820. Early 19th century, right? Yeah.
And our fear at that time was what?
Well, I think really in the 19th century, in the early part of this century, the economic issues were a higher priority with respect to Central America than they are now. You know, there's an interesting quote by Smedley Butler that I used, who was a Marine. I don't know what he was, a captain, or who he talks about. He saved. He saved Mexico for U.S. Standard Oil. He saved. There was, I think, in the early part of the 20th century, the U.S. economic interests of the region were a primary motivating factor. I think it was less national security, okay, in the sense that we're talking about national security today. I think it was much more economics. I think now economics, while it's certainly a factor in our Central America policy, it's not the primary factor anymore, I think. Jim?
Well, Central America was always kind of looked at as a backwater.
Right.
Wasn't really, the only thing we cared about there was the Panama Canal.
Right.
But the issue in the 1820s was that Mexico was occupied by the French, wasn't it?
Yes,
yeah,
right.
French. Mm-hmm. And, we had not been that long getting the British out.
Right.
So, I mean, those were the issues that European powers,
right.
But that changed. But I wanted to ask you is that the, when you talked about the Center for Public Policy, or certainly there are like institutes that have formed the doctrinaire policies of Elliot Abrams and people. And what is the cornerstone of that policy? Obviously, the Reagan administration came in with the intention, first of all, of turning Nicaragua around immediately and
right.
getting rid of Castro also.
Yeah.
And that was on the agenda.
Sure. Right. Well, one of the principal documents that underlies the policy is a document called the Santa Fe Document, it's a pretty frightening document if you read it, and it a lot of the thought into it came out of the Heritage Commission. Some of you are familiar with the Heritage Commission, which is a very Heritage Foundation rather. It's a very right-wing think tank based in Washington. So some of those documents, but see, I think the groundwork for that was laid really. But certainly, the Monroe Doctrine lays part of that. The National Security Act of 1947 really. That's what really created this sort of government within a government, the CIA, and this element, the aspects of the governmental structure that are somewhat inaccessible to Congress and the American public. And that whole national security policy is really carried out by that, as we see tips of the iceberg in things like Ollie North and Contragate and all of that sort of thing. But it really is. It's the Santa Fe document and the Heritage Foundation really build on a structure that's there that's pretty easy to build on.
What would it take? What would it take to dismantle that, or should it be dismantled?
Boy, I don't know. I mean, I think some of it has got to be dismantled. I mean, the whole business of low intensity conflict that we're engaged in right now is just absolutely counter to our democratic principles as a nation. And certainly some aspects of this have to be dismantled, or I think our national integrity is at stake here. Now, how you get at that, I simply don't know. I mean, I don't know how you begin to dismantle some of that.
Yeah.
I was kind of disappointed with Jerry Varney in the direction that he chose in talking about the future and really talking about the involvement of a Christian in redeeming creation and what have you. I thought he would talk more about the future as we see it and happening another 10 and 20 years with political development, etc. And I think we've got some problems in Central America today, but I don't think in 10 years from now they're going to be the problem at all. I think we're going to be forgetting about that because we see things happening in Mexico with the new political aspect, with what we're doing in Tijuana, with the manufacturing we're taking down there. Now we're going to have a major interest in there that may not be able to live with the new political policies.
That's right.
And we're going to have problems.
And given what's happening in Mexico today politically, I think you're absolutely right. I think in the next 10 to 15 years, Mexico is going to be on the forefront of our national security, if you will, in a way that it hasn't been before. I think that's absolutely right.
I have friends that say that members of Parliament want to get out of Mexico.
Of Congress, yeah.
Members of their Congress.
Yeah.
Forget it.
Yeah.
Of the party.
Right.
You touched on Sandinistas shutting down the press.
Oh, yeah.
Of the ambassadors. You never really got that. I'm curious, why did they do that?
Okay. Then we better finish with that. But I think it's really important that I spend a couple minutes on this. Why did the Sandinistas, or people of Rouge Maxion, here go the Sandinistas again, shooting themselves in the foot? There are a couple of things, first of all, one has to recognize here. First of all, they threw out the U.S. diplomats because of involvement in domestic affairs and involvement in staging counter-government demonstrations. Now, the first thing I think we have to accept is something that most of us who have been involved and known for a long time, that what they accused them of is true, all right? They didn't conjure that up, and they've stomached that sort of thing for years and years. This new ambassador came particularly with that agenda. The previous ambassador had a great deal of respect among the Nicaraguans, Berthold. This new ambassador was Abrams' man. I mean, he's worked for Abrams. He came to do Abrams' work. It's very clear that what they were doing is what they accused them of doing, they were doing.